Imagine a group of bioengineers attempting to solve a medical challenge by first creating the most harmful and humiliating solutions possible. This is the approach behind Wrong Theory Protocol, a new technique that seems to result in more empathetic and useful design.
Welcome to Augmented Humanity. Our guests are modern explorers working at the intersection of technology and the humanities. They help us to understand ourselves and the worlds we create in this digital age. They are thinkers, creators, makers, and academics working in diverse fields like linguistics, technology, game and object design, and ethics. I'm your host, Craig Goldsmith.
I'm your host, Ellen Dornan.
We're joined today by the University of New Mexico's Dr. Vanessa Svila, an associate professor in the Organization, Information, and Learning Sciences program and in the School of Engineering, where she is a special assistant to the dean. Dr. Svila is a learning scientist whose research focuses on how people learn when they design. In 2018, she received the National Science Foundation Career Award to study how people develop agency, not just to solve problems, but to frame and reframe them.
Thank you so much for coming on. When you talk about agency or framing agency, what exactly does that mean?
So at its simplest, having agency means you can make decisions. Within that, though, we might think about what kinds of decisions you get to make. Who actually gets to make decisions? When we look at a classroom, for instance, a lot of times students don't get to make very many decisions. They don't get to make decisions about what they're committing time to learning. Even in a project-based classroom, they might be choosing from a menu of options. What president will they do their project on? What biomedical engineering device will they study? And so in these cases, their choices are pretty constrained. And they might get to choose, will I present as a poster or a PowerPoint? But these choices aren't really very consequential. And so when they are faced with having to make a decision that is consequential, sometimes they flounder. And so when we're talking about agency, we're thinking about what kinds of decisions are people getting to make? Do they have the option of making bad decisions that might be consequential, that then they have time to fix, to reframe, to redo? Often we do straight shot approach. If you get one chance to get it right and you don't get it right on that first try, you're evaluated as just not that good. And from this, we learn that failure is somehow bad instead of as an opportunity to learn. So by focusing on agency, and specifically developing agency to frame problems and reframe problems, to say, this is what I'm going to solve, this is the problem I'm going to solve, this is what's important in the problem, here are some things that aren't important in the problem, learning to do that well, that's actually what tells us whether something will become innovative or creative. So we know a lot about how people solve problems. But usually when we're looking at that, we're looking at problems where we already know the answer. So there's not much opportunity to be creative.
Like when you have to work through a math problem or something, is that what you mean, where we already know the answer? And the teacher knows that you're supposed to arrive at this solution? Is that kind of...
Yeah, so when there's a math problem where there's already a right answer and a fastest way to get there, then we push towards efficiency. But we treat all subject areas that way in a lot of cases. So whether it's history, then it's memorizing dates maybe, or who did what and why somebody says it matters, not necessarily why it matters to us. Likewise in science, the science inquiries that we let students engage in, we already know the answer to those typically, even in undergraduate education.
Although in a practical sense, science anyway is all about failing with experiments. It's that kind of iterative process. If I understand this correctly, agency is kind of the free will to be able to fail forward.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you are getting to have decision-making power, that sense of ownership over it and saying, this is the problem I'm going to solve within, whether it's a science question. And if you haven't done it a lot, you're probably going to fail a lot. You're going to pose questions that aren't answerable at first, and you're going to discover yourself that those aren't answerable. Whereas simply hearing from a teacher, oh, don't do that, or no, that's not the purpose, that's not the focus, you don't build that capacity to pose good questions, to pose answerable questions. And the same is true in lots of areas, not just science and math.
When you talk about design, are you talking about designing education curricula, or you mean design in general? Can you tease that out for us?
We're all designers. All of us design. In some fields, it's formal, and there are set processes related to design. So we think of design associated with fields like architecture, engineering, fashion, graphic design. We don't always think about it in other fields like science or teaching, or just in everyday situations, right? You might have designed a child's birthday party or a vacation for your family. By understanding more of the ways that formal design processes could be used and maybe used across disciplines, right? Taking some inspiration from the way designers work in fashion or instructional design, or looking at the ways teachers are designers of learning experiences, we might draw some inspiration. Some fields really emphasize the importance of brainstorming or generating ideas, and others put less emphasis on this. But by thinking about these different places where design happens, sometimes we can find ways to support people to avoid fixation. Right. So fixation is this idea that sometimes we see the way something is and we assume that's the way it's supposed to be. You know, if we just ask people, what do you not like about your BlackBerry phone? And we'd only focused on that.
Your BlackBerry phone.
We would have like really, really slightly better BlackBerry phones now.
Right.
But that insight to say, does it have to be this way? Maybe there are other ways to do this. Finding those ways that people build insight and reframe the problem of maybe it's not just about making the keyboard slightly easier to use, but maybe we don't need a keyboard.
Thinking of like when the iPhone came out, mm-hmm. It was a sort of whole other way of thinking about not even having a keyboard. Your work specifically is trying to actually do this in a formal sense. What led you to start thinking about things in this way?
When we ask people to generate ideas, often they get stuck on an idea that they liked or that they've seen a lot. And it's hard to have ideas that really break out, or sometimes we feel pressured to have a good idea. Mm-hmm. And that stops us from having a great idea. The research shows that this is a challenge for a lot of people, and that a lot of the techniques that we use, if we just say, oh, just brainstorm, come up with as many ideas as you can, that actually doesn't work well. It's based on this idea that if we have a lot of ideas, surely one or two of them will be good. But because of fixation, because of this idea that we get fixed on a particular idea, often they're not so different from our first idea. And sometimes, whether we mean to or not, generate flawed versions of our favorite idea, which, you know, does a good job of making sure our favorite idea will win, but doesn't help us be more creative. I was on an airplane reading a Wired magazine, and there was an article on how artists sometimes deliberately paint ugly art and make bad art that's wrong. And it was referred to as wrong theory, this idea that Degas has painted this pole in front of this, you know, writer. It blocks part of our view. It's unattractive and strange, but it's interesting. And it got me thinking about the way we try to drive at the best idea and how that prevents us from having really, really good ideas. And so I wondered what would happen if instead of trying to come up with the best idea, we started with harmful and humiliating ideas.
Humiliating?
Yeah.
Well, I think that's one of the really interesting things, because when I was taught a formal instructional design mm-hmm. process, we had to start with understanding who our audience was, understanding mm-hmm. who our learners are. And I think working in media or whatever, you always want to, oh, you know, who am I doing this mm-hmm. for? And trying to understand what's humiliating is understanding your audience at a very deep and personal level. I was fascinated at how that process revealed things to the designers that they would not have considered otherwise. I can understand the harm, you know, make a harmful product, but why was the humiliation for you a part of the wrong theory approach?
At first, we actually just went at this thinking, we just asked people to come up with bad ideas. And we tested it out with an instructional design class I was teaching. And it worked really well. I was surprised by how well it worked. People came up with terrible ideas, mm-hmm. right? It was a sort of celebration of like really awful ideas. And I then was working with a high school project, and students were trying to come up with designs made from found materials for temporary shelters for unsheltered clients, mm-hmm. so clients who didn't have a home. And, you know, they got very stuck on this idea of a box, right? You can find a box, and a box is better than nothing, right? And we thought, well, there's so much else that we could do. And so we asked them, you know, to come up with really awful ideas. And in the moment of doing that, you know, at first they were just kind of bad, but some of them got really bad. and some of them brought a lot of humiliation into them. And we started really talking to the kids about, think about both harm and humiliation. And we noticed that the ideas they came up with afterwards, the beneficial ideas they came up with, had so much empathy in them. They were creative. They really thought about the fact that people who are unsheltered, they may want to be hidden when they're trying to sleep. They want to be safe and warm and cozy, but they thought about the needs and the experience. They were able to put themselves into multiple people's points of view and think about that experience. So they notice things about not just the possible solutions, but about the problem. So it changed the way they thought about the problem.
I just want to circle back for a second. Humiliation is kind of a charged word. So when you said in this particular exercise, they were looking for bad solutions that would humiliate the person who had no shelter?
Mm-hmm.
Out of curiosity, what were some of the humiliating solutions? I mean, and when you first said humiliation, I was thinking humiliating the person having the idea. I was imagining people having ideas and everybody going, you're so dumb. But do you remember any examples of...
No, because they were quite vivid. The students got quite graphic with some of their ideas about humiliation in terms of, you know, signs that pointed at a person, making it really clear that that's where they were. So they wouldn't be hidden, right? They'd have neon lights and so forth pointing at them, showing like there's a homeless person here, right? And so avoiding kind of that person first language that we were encouraging them to use. A shelter built out of used toilet paper.
Really
awful things. But then when they went into coming with beneficial ideas, you could see the influence of this. Instead of thinking about a box, right, they thought about a shelter that could be easily and quickly packed up and hidden away, and that when deployed would keep them hidden from other people. They also thought about things like a way to carry family photos. You know, what if you had things that were precious to you, that were meaningful, that then were on the inside of your little shelter so that you could see these things and feel not just you were sheltered, but that you were loved.
At home.
At home, yeah.
I guess I'm curious about how empathy came to be part of the design goal. And I'm thinking about some work that I saw over at the architecture school, or architecture and planning, mm-hmm. where the students had done the same thing. They had been tasked with envisioning shelters or structures that people could create out of found objects. They were beautiful and aesthetic. Some of them, there was one that was a woven wicker cocoon, and it looked so uncomfortable. And I just don't think empathy was part of their design goal or their design process. So how did you come to see it as being valuable?
When we look at the popularization of design thinking, it really encourages us to use empathy, to think about the needs of our stakeholders, our end users, our clients, however we frame, our learners, whoever those people are.
When you mean the popularization, do you mean like all these DIY TV shows and people putting up Pinterest boards? And is that sort of what you mean?
That, but we also see in business, people talk about design thinking. In education, they're talking about design thinking. There's almost a whole industry around it now. When we look at some of the techniques that seem to really help build empathy, people have done things, for instance, where you try to put yourself into someone's situation. If you're trying to design for somebody who's blind, you blindfold yourself and try to navigate something, and you try to put yourself in their shoes. One of the problems with this technique is that it seems to lower your creativity a bit. You tend to get single-minded and focus on that one experience. And in fact, because a blindfold isn't the same thing as not having sight and not understanding what that's really like, it's hard to really place yourself in multiple people's shoes. And so that tends to make you focus on one thing and empathize with one person. And sometimes that leads to low expectation thinking, meaning if I don't really know what it's like to not have sight and I try to experience it by putting a blindfold on myself and wandering, bumbling around a room, I might now think, probably I should make something simple. I haven't really experienced what it's like. So what was interesting with this process with wrong theory is as people were coming up with these terrible ideas and trying to make them worse and worse by adding more harm, adding guaranteed humiliation, it got them really thinking about a range of experiences in there, not just one person's experience. And so we think that's part of why it enhances empathy, but it also helps you notice things about the problem. And by taking away that pressure to have the best idea, it opens you up to having good ideas. We think that's why it works both at enhancing empathy and creativity.
I think that's a nice place to end this segment, actually. It's always nice to end a segment on a positive note, empathy and good ideas rather than humiliation. If you would like to learn more about Dr. Svila's work, you can visit her website, vanessasvila.org. And that's S-V as in Victor, I-H-L-A, vanessasvila.org. Augmented Humanity is a program of the New Mexico Humanities Council, produced in partnership with KUNM-FM. You can visit us online and find out more about our programs at nmhumanities.org. Our theme music comes courtesy James Whiten, and we've had production assistance from Tristan Klum.
So I spend my waking life just driving.